President Biden is following in the footsteps of the Obama administration's bold and fearless policy of delivering to Ukraine everything it needs to defend itself against Russian aggression, except for the weapons it needed to defend itself against Russian aggression, the delivery of which was considered too provocative at the time and could easily have resulted in Russian aggression and the invasion of Ukraine. Since then, the Biden administration has been hard at work, boldly and fearlessly making sure that Ukraine, and the West more broadly, is kept timid and fearful of any and every demonstrably hollow threat that a despot with a gas station-shaped remnant of a once mighty evil empire makes, all while rattling a nuclear saber, the last vestige of power in a decimated country, while its citizens kill themselves either from the highest alcoholism rates in the world, or, more directly, by serving in the seemingly never-ending conflict that is Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Or, at least, never-ending, if the Biden administration has anything to say about it. Conversely, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump claims that he could end the war in just 24 hours, as soon as he imposes the worst possible peace terms on Ukraine in exchange for a pinky promise from Putin that he totally won't break once he's finished resupplying his military with missiles from Iran, artillery shells from North Korea, and drone swarms from China. Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance, suggested that Ukraine's security could then be protected with a demilitarized zone by allowing Russia to keep the entirety of Putin's initial minor incursion. In exchange, the Ukrainian people will have just enough time to mourn their dead, be denied entry to NATO and the European Union, and establish insufficient deterrence before Russia finishes what they started under the next presidential administration, because by then, it'll be someone else's problem. In juxtaposition with the weak-kneed Republican stance, President Biden boldly and fearlessly announced that he would consider the possibility of thinking about potentially commissioning an advisory committee to intensely consult on whether or not to allow Ukraine to use the weapons of war it was given by the United States to actually conduct a successful war. Now, you may be thinking, oh, Sam and Michael, what are you talking about? Under the bold and fearless leadership of President Biden, the presence of well-meaning but ineffectual hashtag stand with Ukraine lawn signs have increased by several thousand percent, not to mention the similar increase in the number of useful idiots that think that the would-be Russian Empire has their best interests at heart. Now, are you trying to tell me that there's more to conducting effective foreign policy than by saying moral and righteous, but ultimately hollow platitudes with no force or follow-through behind them? Are you trying to tell me that the state that's the direct descendant of the Soviet Empire might, just might, be a malign actor on the world stage, and that those who give succor to its immoral war of conquest are being duped harder than Walter Duranty? Look it up. Also, why haven't you released an episode in over a year? What prompted this podcast, other than a desire to not let another year go by without you, dear listener, hearing the prescient political punditry espoused by two dudes who have never gotten even within the same zip code of the State Department, kidding, is that we need to set the record straight. Don't let that intentionally sardonic intro fool you. We're both deeply happy with the fact that the United States, and the West more broadly, has been such a steadfast ally to Ukraine in its fight for survival. But our current policy is failing to bring a successful end to the war, both by preventing the timely delivery of military aid to Ukraine, and then also by placing unnecessary restrictions on said aid when it finally does arrive. Hello and welcome to the Ukrainian Provcast, a series of conversations providing Western listeners with the background, context, history, and geopolitics necessary to understand Russia's war in Ukraine. I'm Sam Bock, and with me is my co-host Michael Williamson. Today, we're going to be talking about just that, the aid to Ukraine, the restrictions placed upon it, and the battlefield impact thereof.
Как дела? Что, тиха украинская ночь, да, как говорил великий украинский писатель Гоголь? Все ли у вас хорошо, ребятки? Нравятся ли вам наши Байрактары?
So, the aid package. We're going to be tackling this episode in semi-chronological order, discussing both the aid package and its initial holdup in Congress, as well as the effects of that, and then turning to the effects of the impositions placed on its use by the United States. And with it to kick it off is the guy who you haven't heard from yet, but ultimately knows more about this topic than I do, Mike. So before I let him rip and roar into this, just to give you a couple of quick dates, when we're starting with the aid package, it was initially proposed by President Biden in September 2023, and then finally, several months later, passed into law and signed by him in April 2024, which is a significant gap. The first topic I want to discuss is the impact of the holdup of such aid.
Thank you, and I can jump in now and just rein me in if I start talking too high up in the clouds, as I'm apt to do on this topic. So it'd be useful, I think, for people to understand what exactly was going on before this aid package was passed and what has occurred since then, because part of the reason that we're bringing this up is we want to make clear the impact that this military aid actually has on the battlefield movements. The outbreak of the war was marked by a very rapid Russian blitzkrieg that was successfully repulsed in a couple key areas, most notably the capital of Ukraine, Kyiv. But Russia maintained a fairly large land bridge from its official border all the way to Crimea.
Where it took in 2014.
That it took in 2014, yes, thank you. Since then, Ukraine had two major opportunities to exploit gaps in the Russian line, where they succeeded in recapturing a sizable chunk of territory and some widely publicized counteroffensives, not the big one that they kept telegraphing for months. But that was really the last significant change of hands in terms of territory. Since that point, the war has primarily been one where Russia has held the initiative, and they have slowly rolled their artillery and ground forces forward, either displacing or completely destroying Ukrainian positions to the point that they can't be defended anymore.
So I think if people have been tuned into the war at all, they've heard it analogized to World War I and the slow, grinding artillery combat that that entails. And I kind of want to focus on that for a second. You mentioned the initial blitzkrieg of the war and the fact that the inertia has slowed down and the lines of battle are much more static than they were initially. So we're discussing this aid package again when there was a significant delay. And I want you to kind of explain, in terms that listeners can appreciate, what was the result of that delay during Sitzkrieg, artillery combat, like the slow inch-by-inch battle that characterized the latter stages of the war?
The immediate impact was that the Ukrainians were firing one shell for every 10 to 20 that the Russians could field. And they had no real other economic option to address the military threat from Russia. They don't really have a sophisticated air force. They don't have the kinds of precision-guided weapons that the Americans have available to them. And maneuver warfare, the style of what you may have seen in the Gulf War, is just kind of out of the question with the amount of defenses that are in place right now. So there was just a lot more mass at the end of the day for Russia to throw at the Ukrainians. And at varying points along the timeline, that mass included bodies and not just shells. So the manpower issue has kind of fluctuated back and forth.
Yeah. And, you know, when we were discussing this episode, I think you brought up a key point, which was it's not just the battlefield impact of the lack of equality between the munitions on each side, but also what that also allowed Russia to do, namely in the degradation of Ukrainian civilian infrastructure in the meantime, and the fact that Ukraine was unable to defend itself as a result.
No, that's a good point. It's good to keep in mind that Ukraine's not just defending its front line, it's also defending its civilians, and it's defending its economy, its civilian infrastructure, most notably its power stations. So it has not just the front line, but the entire country to worry about. And these aid packages, though I may have focused on the artillery shells in my example, they also included a significant amount, or in some cases, not so significant amount of air defenses. Air defense has probably been the single most crucial need for the Ukrainians in this war. Whereas the fighting itself has been marked by artillery and drones, air defense is what enables Ukraine to not turn into something like Syria that the Russians bombed into oblivion back during that civil war. There's a reason Russian bombers don't get free rein to fly over Ukraine right now, and cruise missiles aren't blowing up every children's hospital, school, and power station in the country. That's because they have a decent amount of air defenses right now.
If you've been paying attention to the news at all, dear listener, you might have heard reports of the Russian assaults on civilian infrastructure. Again, hospitals, schools, these sorts of things. The point here being that the ability of Russia to conduct those operations is directly inversely proportional to the ability of Ukraine to defend itself against it by virtue of the fact that we have given them those air defenses and the ability to stop those things. And that's important. Battles are not just won on the battlefield. There's a great phrase that I like, which is not exactly analogous, but steel wins battles, gold wins wars. And the point there being that you can be tactically successful on the battlefield, but if you are decimating the ability of a country to continue on fighting, it is not going to continue on fighting. And a country that is having its civilian population killed and frozen in winters due to lack of power supply and all these sorts of things is not a nation that is going to be able to withstand the continual Russian assault, which has continued the entirety of the war in brutal effect.
And it has had a very significant impact on Ukraine's population. I mean, at least 10 million people have fled that country, and it's a country of 45 million originally, if you're counting the original borders from 91. So yeah, this has been a big, big deal. There are a lot of people that I know personally who lived in Ukraine, they're native Ukrainians, and they won't go back because there's either no economic opportunity, there's no job for them, or there was no air conditioning in the peak of summer, and there's not going to be any heat in the dead of winter.
I think that's a very key point that we just hit on, which is the fact, just how important that military aid was. But I think feeding into that is the, you mentioned counteroffensives, and I think that narrative is linked inexplicably to the US aid. And do you kind of want to give a quick rundown on that? Because as the munitions from the United States and the West started to appear, that is when you started to hear the chatter of the Ukrainian counteroffensive and the, and well, these are two separate things, but the most recent aid package has allowed the incursion into Russia. But why don't you take that?
I would probably start by saying that the hashtag Ukrainian counteroffensive, the big one that they had in 2023, was in some ways a political ploy to garner up more support by demonstrating that Ukraine could retake the initiative on the battlefield. Up until that point, again, they'd had the initial success in the opening 3 months of the war, but the rest of it was largely them being on the back foot. This was them saying that they would take the package given to them by the Americans, which included, you know, the Bradley fighting vehicles, the armored tanks, all these like expensive, fancy ground systems, primarily ground systems, and they would form specialized brigades out of these units and throw them against the Russian line and attempt to basically go all the way to the coast and cut off the land bridge. That operation did not achieve even its minimal strategic objectives. The amount of territory that the Ukrainians ended up retaking was so small it would barely register if you were looking at a map of Ukraine. And part of the reason that was is that we did not give them sufficient stuff in the time that we needed to. And we tried to make them fight the way that an American military would fight. We gave them the kinds of stuff that would be useful for a maneuvering military, not one that's used to fighting with artillery only.
I think that point about the political implications of the aid package is a good one. And the congressional disapproval of the aid is directly tied to the lack of battlefield success that Ukraine wasn't able to show as a result. And I want to give kind of one very quick example that in the fall of 2023, the Congress was able, you know, this in domestic, U.S. domestic political terms gets framed as a, should we be supplying aid to foreign countries or not? And it's a very populist sort of thing to say, you know, what is the point of this? What are we getting out of this? But that same Congress, which was exhibiting opposition to international aid, notably did pass aid to Taiwan and Israel in that time that all three aid packages were put on the floor of the Congress and only two of them passed. There is a very particular domestic political resistance to the supply of Ukraine. And that topic, I think, is too broad and too deep to go into here, but it's worth highlighting. And that really did coincide with the failure of the counteroffensive. So with that, we wanted to bring your attention to what you might have heard in the news more recently, which was Ukraine's incursion into Russia. And this topic is what really spurred us doing the episode in the first place, because the delivery of the aid package, coupled with a minimal relaxation, but a relaxation nonetheless of impositions on the ability of Ukraine to use weapon systems in Russia, is really what allowed this. And both of those two things are absolutely key and show that when equipped appropriately and not having a hand fully tied behind his back, Ukraine is capable of making strategic advances. And as you heard from the vitriolic intro to this episode, that is the thing that we are most squarely taking aim at with the current administration's policy. The fact that as soon as you loosen any restrictions on these weapon systems, you start seeing immediate results show that it was folly in the first place to place those restrictions on. Now, obviously, there's a question of, as I also mentioned in the intro, Putin rattling the nuclear saber and threats of nukes, which would break a seal which has been in place since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, obviously. That's not uncredible, but the point is that over the duration of this war, every single time that the United States has argued against itself and argued that the use of this additional weapon system or this additional thing would be too provocative has proven time and time again to draw no significant difference in reaction from Russia. And the fact that, again, Ukraine is now seeing this success, it's an example of the frustration that we feel observing this war.
And just to explain to people listening, those restrictions that we're referring to are typically placed on the most advanced weapon systems that the Americans or even its partner states in the European Union send to Ukraine. Think, if you've heard the acronym ATACMS, what that is a ballistic missile. So anything with a range, think over 100 miles or so, generally speaking, it's not allowed to be used on the territory of Russia for fear of escalation. At least that was the policy until right around April or May this past year. I have an interesting anecdote because I visited Ukraine in December, and right after I left, the city that I was in, I spent some time in Kharkiv, got bombed quite badly for a prolonged period of time. And it was when these rules, these restrictions were lifted on American weapons right across the border from Kharkiv, which was an area that the Russians were shelling Kharkiv from. As soon as that rule changed, the bombing stopped. The Ukrainians were able to target the bases, the troop concentrations, the artillery positions, the drone operators, all that were sheltering on the Russian side of the border. And it's not very far. Like, to give you a sense of the scale, I mean, the town that I lived in was maybe 15 miles from the Russian border, and that's in the Kharkiv region. And this came off the back of the Russians pouring across the border and trying to push their artillery guns into range of the city proper. So us removing the restrictions on longer, more advanced, more precision-guided weapon systems to the Ukrainians to be used on Russian territory directly resulted in saved civilian lives, saved civilian infrastructure in this one city. And what we're hoping is that we can duplicate that across hopefully the entire front, maybe even a bit deeper.
I just want to focus on the absurdity of that situation for a second, because what sort of, like, what does anyone think is going to be the ultimate outcome of a military fighting for its survival that is unable to strike its enemy directly across the line that is sacrosanct for it? It can't move across the territorial border, but the enemy is launching a war of aggression in which it is invading that territory across the border. It's so cooked, for lack of a better term, and it's just, like, on its face, it is obvious that that's no way to prosecute a military campaign, but that's the imposition that the United States placed upon Ukraine as a condition of receiving that aid. And the frustration here is that, so this incursion, it was very effective, much more effective than the, you know, counteroffensive that Mike was talking about earlier. Just to give you some numbers, it went about 20 miles deep into Russia, 750 square miles, 95 villages, all controlled by Ukrainian advancements as opposed to Russia now, and very successful just by this one little thing. So the fact that for so long we prevented Ukraine from executing effectively is, and I'm repeating myself on this point, but it's worth driving home. This is the key point of this episode, that Ukraine is not a losing battle. It's not a foregone conclusion. It's not a lost cause. It only is if we make it so. And if we were to provide them with the equipment they needed to win and get out of the way and let them successfully prosecute the war, they've been very successful and incredibly inventive. One of the most ingenious militaries in the world right now, I would argue, maybe other than behind the IDF in terms of, and Mike can discuss this in more detail, but just the level and interesting types of technology that they've created and deployed on the battlefield as a result of necessity. Necessity is the mother of all invention. You know, their ability to, and we'll talk about this more later, but Ukraine's ability to move Russia out from its borders on the Black Sea with basically scraps compared to what the Russian Navy has, it's unbelievable. And the fact that congressional Republicans in particular argue that Ukraine is not worth expending U.S. treasure on because it's a losing battle, that is a losing battle of their own making. And that's what the point that we're trying to get across in the opening specifically.
No, this is great. And I want to make sure I don't jump around all over the place here. But one other point I'd like to highlight is the pressure that's currently on Putin to prosecute this war right now. Because it's all and well that Ukraine can make gains, but if they can't actually bring about enough political pressure on Putin to convince him to leave, because the Ukrainians are obviously not going to occupy Moscow, like the, you know, victory through conquest is not on the table. Only victory by breaking their morale is. Putin has not yet hit the button on general mobilization. That would be a general military-aged compulsory draft. He has not yet done that. He still refuses to call this a war. He's continued to call it a special military operation. He has a major incentive to downplay the significance of the war. At least he did until, you know, NATO countries got more heavily involved with supplying arms to the Ukrainians. But there's a reason he hasn't done that yet. This is not the move of someone who has a complete and total vice grip on the country. Neither was the whole Prigozhin thunder run to Moscow that never really went anywhere. But I digress. The best that he's been able to achieve is a partial mobilization. And each time that he's had to run these mobilization waves, he's been very, very hesitant to do so. And they've tended to pool from the outlying rural regions of Russia and staying away from the political centers of St. Petersburg and Moscow, which are kind of like the two main population centers of Russia, which are all in the Eastern European quarter, by the way.
And not just population centers, but also where the well-to-do elites who would actually be able to exert pressure on the government of Putin reside.
Exactly. Like, the people who are actually in power in Russia are not being affected by this war, generally speaking. And Putin is doing everything that he can to prevent them from being affected, because then his power base could actually, you know, be compromised.
I think the not jumping around is already We've already crossed that river over the Donbass at this point. So we're just going to jump around, and you're just going to have to deal with it, dear listener. But I do want to spend a little bit more time on the incursion
into Kursk specifically. So now we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Because that did garner a lot of headlines. And at the very least, I want people to come away from this episode understanding what the strategic importance of it was. And we haven't touched upon that yet. And from my perspective, and then I'll obviously let you jump in here, is that first and foremost, this is a bargaining chip. There is lots of talk of a negotiated settlement, a peace, a ceasefire, whatever you want to say. And up until this incursion, it was Russia holding all the territorial cards. Russia was the only party who held the other country's territory. Now, although it's not major by any scale, you know, it's like Russia's incursion is 200 times more or more the size of what Ukraine's captured in Russian territory, but it is something now at this point. And for the first time in a long time, Ukraine has something that they can bring to the bargaining table in somewhat of a position of strength. Now, this hasn't, in terms of battlefield tactics, this hasn't really stalled Russia's advance in the east of the country or anywhere else, but it's worth thinking about. That's my takeaway from it.
It's true that it's not, you know, if you compare the amount of territory that Ukraine has seized from Russia recently, that the total size of that territory is not that big compared to what Russia has seized from Ukraine since 2014. But in the context of the slow grinding pace of the offensive of the last 2 years, this is a blitzkrieg in comparison. I mean, the amount of territory the Ukrainians took in a couple of days is equal to or greater than what the Russians have achieved over the course of the entire last year. And it's being done on Russian proper territory, no less. And now they're currently digging in. And like you said, we think Ukrainians have been fairly tight-lipped about what they hope to achieve from this. But the current thinking is that this is part of, A, peace dividend that they can use as, you know, leverage in a negotiation. And B, is a gambit to force the Russians to redeploy away from their current areas of interest in Donbass.
Which hasn't really happened.
Which like sort of has and sort of hasn't. It's a little bit unclear. Initially, reports were that the Russians were pulling from every area besides Pokrovsk, is the name of the main battle in Donbass right now. They were pulling from everywhere besides Pokrovsk, but more recently, a few brigades have been photographed operating in the Kursk area that were previously occupying the front lines in Donbass. So it's unclear at this time how much Russia has actually pulled, although Ukrainian estimates put it as high as 60,000 troops. So it's not insignificant. I mean, the Russian response is beginning to strengthen, and we don't quite know where this is going to fall and whether this strategic gambit is going to pay off for Ukraine in the end or not.
A couple other points I want to hit on this subject, which is one, that this is the first time in the war that Ukraine has crossed over to Russian territory. And what was the result? Crickets. Really, from my eye, the war has continued to be prosecuted by Russia in exactly the same manner it was prior to the incursion. So again, this is just, and this is a point that I'm going to keep hitting on, this is an example where the US's fearfulness of Russian escalation, even when they're already invading the territory, was all for naught. Like, I can't imagine a bigger red line other than a direct assault on Moscow or something than going into their territory and nothing from them. So that's worth highlighting.
For all the talk of red lines, yes.
This exactly.
You would have thought this would have been a much more serious red line to cross, and the response has been a fairly conventional one from the Russians thus far.
Exactly. And another one, just a very minor point. Mike brought this up when we were doing research on this episode, but Kursk has symbolic significance from World War II. It was a town in which the German advance was stopped there, and it's not that this really matters, but history is funny, and it's just notable that Ukraine has moved into Russian territory isn't really getting any airplay on Russia generally, but also specifically regarding this symbolic town.
Rolling in with German-made tanks, no less.
Yeah, the thing I always joke about is it took Germany 3 times, but they finally managed to conquer Europe. Anyway, so there's one other thing that I want to highlight over the course of this war that is, it's not determinative, but for me, it was a really interesting anecdote when researching this episode, which is that the differential in casualties versus population of Russia and Ukraine. This is going to be a very bloodless statement to make, and I apologize for kind of the lack of empathy in this statement, but Russia is about 3 times larger than Ukraine by population, whereas its battlefield casualties over the course of this war is 5-1. Now, if you think of these as 2 lines on a graph, you let those play out over time, and there is a certain point in which they intersect that, in some sense, one could argue, and it doesn't really work this way, could be favorable. And This doesn't really have a point other than highlighting that, which I found to be a very interesting and potentially telling statistic that people think of Russia as this indomitable, endless supply of humans to throw at a problem, which it is and it has, but there is going to ultimately where that math might not play out the way it has been before.
We're bringing this up because this is one of the key counter arguments brought up by detractors from against Ukraine aid, is that Russia is too big, Putin will not stop, and that Ukraine doesn't actually have a realistic chance of stymieing their advance. I would beg to differ. The casualty ratios have been in Ukraine's favor nearly this entire war. The only periods where they weren't were under the most absolute desperate of circumstances when they were all surrounded or intentionally held a line with what little they had. But by and large, this war has been Russia throwing meat waves of bodies against prepared Ukrainian defensive lines. And it's been resulting in casualties at a minimum of 3-1 in the favor of Ukraine. And you'd have to think that, being the people fighting for their own survival, the Ukrainians are probably willing to tolerate a good bit more pain and hardship than the Russians are in this pursuit. So it is my continuing thesis that they absolutely do have a chance of bleeding Russia out in this fight, and they actually can outlast them, certainly provided with the right weapon systems and capabilities.
What happens if you increase that ratio by providing Ukraine the ability it needs to more effectively conduct its operations? What if through the use of additional artillery shells and additional bullets, which it was running out of, all these basic things, that ratio went up from 5-1 to 7-1? I don't think that's impossible to imagine. And then all of a sudden, that timer that's ticking on the Russian advance starts ticking a lot faster.
Yeah, if I'm thinking of some of the more high-profile systems that we sent them 6 HIMARS trucks in the very beginning of the war. And that immediately resulted in just detonations all across Donbass and Crimea of Russian ammo depots, fuel depots, troop concentrations. And then immediately following that, we had the flashy Kherson and Kharkiv counteroffensives when the Ukrainians were most successful in retaking a whole bunch of territory. That was off the back of essentially one precision-guided long-range weapon system that we gave them. One. Since then, we've seen the Russians adapt somewhat to the HIMARS system because it relies on GPS to guide its weapons into target, and the Russians are really good at scrambling that now. Their electronic warfare is excellent. There are lots of other things that we could be doing, but we aren't doing them because we refuse to give them any more than 30 M1 Abrams tanks or, 6 F-16s. By the way, we didn't even do that. That was the Netherlands or Denmark or whatever, but not us. So
those fighting Dutch.
Yeah, exactly. There's this meme going around that we're bleeding out our coffers, that we are running out of weapons to give Ukraine. And it is for lack of a better word, it's total BS. The fact is that when someone says that we've ran dry of our stocks of 10 years worth of HIMARS ammunition or Stingers or Javelins or whatever, yeah, it's because we weren't making them essentially for 10 years. So if you use those figures, of course it's going to look like we're running through stocks at an unprecedented rate. Because after the Gulf War, for people who... Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say exactly. After the Gulf War, the shape of U.S. military preparedness changed markedly when we were focused on expeditionary forces abroad, nation building, which terrific ideas, and the type of military that the United States, the military paradigm that the United States was operating under shifted significantly from a great power's traditional combat stance to one that was focused on fighting abroad in the wars against terrorism after 9/11. And as it turns out, there is still great power conflict, and the United States was once the industrial base of the world, and this is, again, a broader topic than we can really get into now, but if it was of utmost importance for the survival of this country, there is no doubt in my mind that we could do what it was necessary to produce ourselves into a successful military outcome. And there's there's all sorts of dysfunction in Congress, including the appropriations process where, the congressional budget is written 1 year at a time instead of allowing for the U.S. military to conduct multi-year strategic reviews of systems and planning and all that sort of stuff. And again, far broader topics than we can get into today. But if we got our act together, shipped Ukraine what it needed, beefed up our industrial base, and took the world seriously, which we're obviously not right now, it's not even close. The line that I threw in during the intro of this episode, the reference the gas station, is that was a famous quote from John McCain in, I believe, around 2012, after he was running for president, which is, Russia is a gas station with an army. And there's all this talk about Russia being this indomitable threat and, can't invade Russia in the winter, ha ha ha, all this sort of stuff. But I don't know, as it turns out, they're not very good at this. And if we just ex ante, everyone evaluating the conflict prior to it breaking out, our initial response was to offer Zelensky a ride out of there because everyone thought that there was no way Ukraine could save itself. As it turned out, he gave that famous sermon where he says, I don't need a ride, I need bullets. And this country, which nobody would have thought would have been able to withstand the Russian advance, has done so quite successfully and could be much more successful if, again, we could just get out of our own head, get out of the way, and let this country, which so desperately wants to fight for its survival, do so.
And we're not exactly bankrupting ourselves by doing it either. Like, I want to disabuse anyone listening of that notion right now. We are neither bleeding out our coffers, nor are we disarming ourselves and neutering ourselves in the face of China. For better or worse, our defense industrial base is a capitalist one, and supply typically does not exist absent demand. You need something to incentivize the major defense suppliers to restart their production lines. And we didn't have that for a very long time. The paradox, well, not the paradox, but like, oddly enough, having to send Ukraine all these weapons has encouraged our defense industrial base to restart those production lines. And we're now producing things at a much faster rate. And that's happening all across Europe as well. Now, Europe has dipped so much into the peace dividend that they're now latched to all these crazy social welfare policies, which we won't get into. So they're having trouble meeting up their demands. But still, this rearmament process would not be happening, period, without the war. And it's frankly something that we needed to do anyway, given the rise of China.
No, it's a dangerous world out there. We are not up to the threat environment that is not even approaching, that's there, that we have our fingers and our ears and our eyes closed, pretending doesn't exist. In addition to successfully degrading Russia's capacity to wage war on the continent, which I think is a valuable strategic objective for the United States, another outcome of this war being the U.S. begins to take seriously its defense industrial base and starts building up the munitions necessary to prevent a war. If you want peace, prepare for war. That would be another positive outcome.
Deterrence is much cheaper than fighting a war, is another way to put it.
Exactly. And you can have whatever misgivings about the Ukrainian state, warranted or unwarranted, that you want. But the point that we've made in this podcast, not this particular one, but in the Ukrainian podcast generally, is that whatever your opinions are, it is of great benefit to the United States. The very successful operation that Ukraine's conducting, essentially, I mean, not on our behalf, but ultimately on our behalf in some sense. And the fact that we can't even let an ally, it's not quite the right term, but conduct that sort of thing is beyond me.
I'd go so far as to call them an ally. They're waving our flag, playing our national anthem, and putting it on their uniform. But yes,
yeah, not officially. Not that's
maybe not bound by treaty explicitly. That's a muddy area. If I may, I'd like to rapid fire some air, ground, and sea updates to really show people what exactly is going on.
Yes, please.
Like, when I say that Ukraine is teetering on the edge of actually being able to push the Russians out, in some cases it actually has. If we look at let's break this down: sea, land, air. We'll start with air. Air. Russia still doesn't have air superiority. This is supposed to be the second strongest air force in the world. They can't even fly past the front line for fear of being shot down, primarily by American Patriot systems and other such things. I mean, look, we are 2.5 years in, almost three, into a war where the world's second largest air force has to hide 50 kilometers behind its front line most of the time.
That's a very effective air force, right? They can really conduct successful operations 50 miles behind their own lines.
And the Ukrainians don't even really have F-16s yet. Like, they have a token force of five now because that one crashed. Great. But there's so much more that they could do. And you don't even need to give them fancy jets. Just give them more air defenses, and that'll at least deny the airspace and enable them to, at the very least, protect their civilians and their energy infrastructure so that people are willing to live in that country because life has to go on. In the sea, okay? Why is the sea important? It's because Ukraine is a major exporter of agricultural goods. That's how it sustained its economy primarily throughout this war. And, you know, it has one major port left, and Russia attempted to blockade that port, and they have now been chased out of not just that area, but out of Crimea. The Russian Black Sea port lost its flagship, the Moskva, if you remember that sinking, and then was kicked out of its home port. The same one, like, for context, go ahead.
That's really worth just putting a total pin on, which is the initial incursion into Ukraine in 2014 was one that was not excused by the world, but there was sort of a, oh, well, it's understandable why Russia would need to control this territory because they need access to the Black Sea. This is of utmost strategic importance. And if you look at it historically, maybe it was in Russia's territory and during the USSR and everything. This territorial incursion by Russia in 2014, it was distinct from the more recent one that it has taken in Ukraine, insofar as there was this general understanding of, like, this is so important for Russia that of course it was going to take this. And as a result of the latest round of fighting, it has actually lost that thing, which was, by other people's admission, like, of utmost importance.
Russia has coveted Crimea for hundreds and hundreds of years. It has been an object of attention of the Russian Empire and various other empires for a long time. It's very strategically significant given its position. Just take my word for it, bro. And the big thing that convinced the Russians to allow the Ukrainians to have their independence in the first place was the fact that Ukraine was going to lease their port in Crimea to the Russians for about 30 years. And right as that leases coming up was when the Russians came in and just decided to take all of Crimea anyway.
Imagine the fact that you can't trust X-year leases with authoritarian states. See Hong Kong and China.
See Hong Kong and China, yeah. What's interesting about the naval campaign is that, to the best of my knowledge, it's been fought mostly with homegrown, domestically produced Ukrainian weapons. They didn't even use American stuff for this. I mean, there were some, I believe there were some Western missiles used in the attack on the Moskva itself. But since then, it's primarily been these RC boats, like literally sea drones that have been torpedoing boats. And then occasionally like some air-launched or ground-launched long-range missiles that have hit these boats. And like Russia lost an attack submarine in port the other day. I mean, these are like some serious, serious casualties for the Black Sea Fleet. And they're now operating much further from where they could. And that's significant because now they can't blockade Ukrainian exports. They can't use those ships as missile platforms to hit areas they otherwise would have more trouble hitting in Ukraine proper. This is a major, major victory for Ukraine. And they did this, honestly, without that much American assistance beyond maybe some recon up in the air that we're being tight-lipped about. And then on the ground, I mean, there's so much more to say about the ground. I won't go too deep into it, but...
No, please.
The fact that Ukraine's managed to hold on for this long period is a testament to the efficaciousness of their armed forces. The casualty ratios are in their favor. They are typically ahead of the curve in terms of innovation, just not on scale. So Russia tends to like copy the ideas that the Ukrainians come up with and then try to implement them with their larger industrial base. But, you know, we're sitting here in 2024 and Ukraine is occupying a significant portion of European Russia. Like, not a part that they don't completely care about, but like you said, the site of the old Battle of Kursk. This famed Soviet victory, the biggest tank battle in human history over the Nazis. And the Ukrainians are currently sitting and squatting on top of it saying, "Nana da boo-boo, what are you going to do?"
Slav squat.
Yeah, Slav squatting, nice. And the Russians still have not completed their conquest of Donbass. And yeah, if that doesn't explain something to you, I'm not really sure what will. So things have not gone as bad as we all predicted for the Ukrainians. And every time we give them, you know, a modicum of capability, they do in fact figure out how to use it. They do in fact figure out how to maintain it. And they might even do so in a way that we weren't thinking of them doing to begin with. Things like the Patriot missile system that we gave to them. You know what that thing's supposed to do? It's supposed to be parked in the capital, nice and safe, shooting down ballistic missiles, maybe intercepting a bomber if it comes too close. You know what the Ukrainians did? They drove that sucker off to the front line, like within probably 10 to 15 miles, and they shot down some Russian command jet that was flying over the Black Sea, of which they only had about like a dozen of, give or take. That was like a major, major thing. And they sambushed it, we call it. That's not something that the American...
Hey, leave me out of this.
Yeah. I only bring this up to highlight the fact that, like you said, necessity is the mother of all invention. And oh my God, are they facing a wall of necessity right now? And if we just gave them a few more tools, I mean, it's had demonstrable positive battlefield outcomes for them every time we've done this. And we're continuing to fight with the gloves on rather than off.
Exactly. So to be a college essay about it and restate our thesis one more time, if we could just get Ukraine what it needs, get out of the way, boy howdy, they have been successful thus far, and one can only imagine the success that they will have in the future. And one other just note for posterity, we are recording this on September 15th, 2024, and as of recording, there has not been authorization or the full-scale use of U.S. assets in Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So this episode might be totally out of date by the time that it airs, but not really, because the point is that we still unnecessarily tied Ukraine's hand, at least one hand, behind its back for the majority of the war up until now. Any closing thoughts?
Let me make one more note if I could.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, one more note if I could. To the proponents of a ceasefire along the current terms, my problem with this, my problem with what I've heard from Trump, my problem with what I've heard from J.D. Vance is not necessarily that I'm opposed to a ceasefire per se. It's that they are talking about a ceasefire without any addendum saying, but we're also going to arm the Ukrainians sufficiently to deter the next fight. That's the problem. What I see here is a lot of politicking to get this war off of specific politicians' plates in a timely manner, but they're not concerned about what's going to happen in the next 4 to 5 years. And that's what the Ukrainians have been saying this entire time. If we pause now, all that's going to happen is what happened last time. We made a ceasefire with the Russians, which they used the time to rearm and reposition in a more advantageous area and then attack again. And so there is no ceasefire that succeeds without also footing a bit of a bill to arm them sufficiently. I mean, if we're going to make them negotiate, can we at least have them negotiate from a stronger position and not, you know, if we're going to have to arm them anyway, why not just do it now?
So with that, we wanted to thank all our listeners for tuning in to yet another episode of the Ukrainian Provcast. We promise that the next one will be in less time than a year. We're going to try to roll these out more consistently, maybe not as frequently as we did at one point, but be on the lookout. And so if you enjoyed this sort of anti-US bipartisan hatred fest of the ineffectual policies of both parties, then you will enjoy the next episode as well, where we will discuss something else apropos to the current situation in Ukraine. So on behalf of Mike and myself, Sam, we'll be back again with another episode soon. But in the meantime, keep up the fight.
Все ли у вас хорошо, ребятки? Нравятся ли вам наши байрактары?
Hosted by Sam Bach and Michael Williamson. Audio production by Sam Bach. Artwork by Eli Bach. Music by Mark Fusito.